The first question we wanted to ask you was, how and why did you first get involved in the housing community?
Good question. Well, I'm a researcher at UBC. I'm a prof in psychiatry and was interested in genetics. That's the kind of work I do. But then I got interested in the question of gene-environment interactions. And so, of course, that led me to what were the interactions? And everybody knew what the genes are, and there's a million people doing work on looking for genes and all that kind of stuff. So I decided to go look at the environment. And so, you know, I do work in mental illness. So what happened is we're looking for those things out in the environment, whether it be housing or trauma or how you worked with your mother, kind of stuff like that, that might have triggered the genes for mental illness. Either turned off the genes that protect you from it, or turn on the genes and you have a liability. So that's how I got interested in that. And so as I got interested in researching it, I got involved in community groups and volunteer work, you know, on housing issues and mental illness issues and homelessness and all that kind of stuff. And that became more interesting than the genetics, which I still do. But that became just another track in one's career. And then over the years, I did that over, I guess, a 10-year period or something like that. And then a bunch of people said I should run for politics, so here I am. I needed a sabbatical. I hadn't been on sabbatical yet at UBC for years. So. My first one. So,
in that regard, like, what was the first organization you kind of worked with once you started getting interested, like, involved?
Well, I guess the main one, it's not so much a first. I'd always been interested in psychology, so I'd worked with the Canadian Mental Health Association, and these issues always came up. Mm. Or some. But the main one, I think, was Collingwood Neighborhood House. And right in my own neighborhood where I live near Joyce Road there, and I'm on 16th and Renfrew, where I grew up, so it was my neighborhood. And there'd always been homeless folks around there. We've known about them for a long time. And so we started doing programs of that. And that's how I got started. Actually, with drug addiction, I think, was the other thing, because there was a lot of... We helped get in the first needle exchange in the neighborhood outside of the downtown east side. Everybody else was going to the downtown east side because it was sort of a glamorous place to go and do work, but I couldn't care. For me, it was more like, well, you know, charity begins at home. So I started my own neighborhood.
So when you, talk about the kind of mental health issues you've kind of dealt with over the years, kind of working in there, do you notice it? When, like, is it kind of, I guess I want to ask, like, when you're kind of doing your work, or when you're researching, or just doing your community work, is it kind of a noticeable thing that there's mental health issues at work?
Sure. I mean, certainly when really came, you know, well, it depends on the neighborhood. Like, different neighborhoods seem to have different folk. So down in the downtown east side, there's a lot of folks with all sorts, you name it, they had everything. Usually dual diagnosis, so that means they had addiction plus some other major psychiatric problem, whether it be post-traumatic stress disorder, whether it be schizophrenia, whether it be a personality disorder, bipolar depression. Often they had a number of them all at the same time. And so they were attracted to that neighborhood because of cheap housing and drugs, because a lot of times they were self-medicating. That's how it often starts. You know, I'm depressed, so I make myself feel better by shooting up, and then you get into that spiral. Out in my neighborhood, they were a lot more functional. So these are folks who had maybe a mild personality disorder, or they were depressed, or they had brain damage, organic brain damage. But they were functional in the sense that they could actually do enough to survive without, you know, having to go to hospital. And so as we found out later on what they were doing, they all had places to live, or they mainly hung out somewhere else, took the SkyTrain into East Vancouver, to Collingwood, or rather for Collingwood, because a great place to be panhandling was up and down Kingsway. And so they were there for their job, and then they'd go back and spend it somewhere else. But psychological, psychiatric problems are pretty prevalent in the area. But they're not all just schizophrenia, like people hear voices and things like that. We have people with brain damage, a lot of brain damage, whether construction workers or something got hit on the head, or a lot of abused folks who, you know, suffered other forms of trauma by being sexually abused and things like that. Either, you know, ran away from home, became a prostitute, and they were beat up by a John, or some other kind of, or, you know, they pimped their ass out and they had a really bad experience with it, right? So so there's a whole polygon in the mix. So there's no one kind, there's a real variety, and it's all quite severe.
So I guess along that regard is like your history with mental health, with mental illness. Do you know anything about, I guess, kind of the history of mental health? Like, weren't there hospitals around and mm-hmm. and to take care? And like, what happened to that kind of?
Well, you know, it goes back to there was Riverview, was sort of the main psychiatric hospital for the region, and it was out in Coquitlam Center Mall, pretty much, right, Riverview, or Essendale, as it used to be called. And it was an institution, and at the time, the zeitgeist in psychiatry and psychology was to move people from institutions into communities, because they do better there. However, during the 80s, I guess when that occurred, they didn't actually have enough community support, so a lot of these folks landed up on the street. But that wasn't the only reason why. There was homeless folks there currently. I mean, that was a long time ago. A lot of these folks are dead now or disappeared. You know, I used to see them. Now I don't see them. And what we're finding now for the problems down there are folks coming here for cheap drugs, or folks from our own neighborhoods going, you know, because of the availability of all sorts of illicit substances, as well as the lack of affordable housing, which has caused a lot of the homelessness. The federal government pulled up 92, so under Paul Martin and the federal liberals, they decided they weren't going to build, they're getting out of the housing business. CMHC more or less stopped building co-ops, and people couldn't afford to live. The BC government, when they took power in 91, I guess it was 1999, what, 2001, again pulled out of housing completely, as well as social supports and social housing and everything else. It's simply part of their austerity program. You know, when they won that huge majority, and of course we're paying for it now. Over the last 2 years, they're playing scrambling catch up because of the huge problems on our street, but still they're far behind.
So what do you think then is the kind of like, how do you solve a lot of these mental health issues as well as the issues of homelessness?
Well, they're all integrated, so you just can't solve one. Right, you have to solve all of them at the same time. So, you know, there has been, quite frankly, very little leadership at the provincial or federal levels on this. So we as a city has taken that call up. You know, it comes at some political risk because people say, oh, it's not your job, you shouldn't be doing that. But I'm a tenured prof at UBC. If I don't get reelected, I don't care. Right. So that makes it freer for me to do what I want. And quite frankly, the mayor is out there. We campaigned on it very strongly. And we decided to take leadership. So the leadership is this. We created something called urban health teams. So that is a comprehensive approach to solving something. So it takes people from housing, it takes people from social development, people from Vancouver Coastal Health, it takes a wide variety of folks, police, whatever, working together on a single problem, as opposed to being off in their own little silos doing their own thing. So one of the things we did was open shelters. Right, you've heard about the shelters throughout Vancouver. We have three large shelters and four smaller ones open for the winter. But instead of just opening shelters, we made sure that the shelters were open, had psychiatric, psychological help in there, or people going down. So when people came in off the street, we made sure it was safe and it provided nutritious food. Number one job, give them decent food. Not just donut and candy and all that kind of bullshit that you get at the other places, donuts and stuff. But actual things like roast beef dinners or shepherd's pie or what have you. Something that's actually nutritionally balanced. So that started to stabilize the folk. Right, so they were actually, we moved them from the street into a shelter which provided quote-unquote safety. You stayed alive, survival. The next phase, of course, we started working with the province, what we call open interim housing. So this is housing that is leased. Well, let me back up a little bit. Generally, the provincial policy has been to create nothing but permanent housing, which is great. We're totally in agreement with that. In fact, the city had purchased and provided 14 plots of land for that, with the province supposed to build it and actually run it. Six of those were started this year because we pushed the province, but they've been focused very much on permanent housing, which is great. No problem with that. However, to get the 14 sites built, it's going to be 5 years, 3 to 5 years. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, pretty much everybody said at this point, well, who cares? Not our problem. That's city said, you know, don't matter. The province said, oh, let them wait. We'll build it fast. It never happened. Right? To be honest, it never happened. So we said, okay, screw you. We have to do something. So first thing we did is we have to make sure you stay alive. So we opened the shelters. And with that approach, comprehensive approach, people came inside, got safe, got fed, and got stable. Then phase two, which we started and we're working on now, is, the shelters can't stay open forever. They're groups. They're not really, I mean, they're a place to get safe, but they're not a real place for stability. So we started to open up interim housing. So this is places where people can live for 3 to 5 years until the permanent stuff is ready. So we have two examples of that. One is Dunsmuir House, down in the corner of Dunsmuir and Seymour. Dunsmuir and Seymour Street. And so we opened that up with the province. So the folks from the shelters can live there for 3 to 5 years. And then when they're ready, move to the permanent housing that's available. And the other one is the Bosman Motor Hotel that we partnered with the Mental Health Commission of Canada as well as the province. And that is an old hotel on 1050 Howe Street, which will be part of the Housing First project. So people from the shelters, street people will be brought in, given a place to live, as well as delivering mental health services on site. Right, and then after the three-year project's done, hopefully they can move on into the permanent housing or just be better and off the streets permanently. Mm. And in order to gauge our progress, we had a homeless count yesterday that the city sponsored, cost us $70,000, in which to send out 300 volunteers across the city to actually count who's in shelter, who's not, and to get a handle on who's homeless and where they are. So that's what we've done. So that's our approach. Provide continuum housing with supports. And of course, we had to partner with the to get the supports in was tough because that's not city mandate. City mandate is land use and building use. Mm. And the province's coastal health and all that has got to do all that stuff. So we actually brokered it. We said, look, bring your nurses in to the shelters. Bring your nurses into Dunsmuir House. We'll help support with some money, some expertise. And we have agreements now in order to do that. This would be the first time.
As it was described to me, you have the mayor's ear on housing issues. how did that kind of come about, that relationship?
Well, I don't have the mayor's ear. I think we all have the mayor's ear on a whole bunch of things. We work as a caucus. I think because of my work over the years in housing and mental illness and homelessness, I'm the one who's done most of the work on it and has the most experience. But it's very much a collaborative effort because, I bring the mental health and that portion in, but we also have other counselors who've worked in the field. Counselor Andrew Reimer, for example, actually was a street kid for a little while. She spent some time on the street. So she has a very unique perspective from that point of view, which has been very helpful. I have sort of the medical, psychiatric, psychological perspective. She has the user perspective. And so on and so forth, whereas the mayor certainly has, from his relationship with the province, being an MLA before, has the governmental, knows who to call, knows who he can push and where to push, and certainly our chief of staff, Mike McGee, has worked in nonprofit societies most of his career, raising money, actually administering donor money and things like that to nonprofit groups, do this kind of work. And I've had a very close relationship with people like over the years, just working in the field, other activists as well as some of the housing folks here at the city. So we all work together. We consult each other quite a bit. We don't always agree, but we always manage to work something out. So I don't know. I guess that's why. You split us into portfolios. We got elected and said, "You're doing this. You're doing this. You're doing that." Sounds like one for you, Jang. So I said, "Gee, like, you give me that tough one. Give me an easy one. Give me parking." So he gave me easy park. I said, "Okay, well that's all right." The Chinatown parking named after me. I don't know.
So you have on your website a story from the Sun about the 10th city.
You guys actually read the website? Amazing. Yeah. I don't think anybody ever looked at it. Hey, 10 bucks a month to keep it going. I don't know.
The story was about 10th city, about the finding housing for the people in 10th city.
Yep.
Do you want to tell me about how you kind of organized such kind of quick housing finding?
I can't take credit for it. I think it's our city staff. I think the first thing we had to do with that 10th city is, I mean, we knew from the get-go that it was a mix of people who were, well, mostly activists at the time, so people who had homes who were protesting, right? And we came to an agreement with them that, and so what our worry was initially was they would actually take homeless people into the camp, and the argument being that the camp was safer than the streets. Mm-hmm. That was debatable, because where they wanted to set up their camp was not in that lot where they did set up, but all over the city on sidewalks and stuff, which is not only a bylaw infraction, but health and safety, because you can get run over, you can get knocked over, people can trip over your tent. So it was health and safety for those around as well as people there. So we had a lot of difficulty. Well, not really a lot of difficulty, but we certainly had a very different opinion as to how this protest should roll out. And so we said to them, look. So as it turned out, they understood our concerns. So they made sure they honored, you know, that they didn't, you know, trespass and, you know, do it on city property or public property. And we told them very, and we, and this is absolutely true, we're very supportive of their call for a federal housing program. And so there it is, the very first day of the protest, I was down there with them saying, you know, we need a federal housing program. And then they, you know, we came to an agreement as to how the protest would run out. So that was fine. So they set it up on private property to solve that problem, and we made sure we had our health and safety workers go in every day to make sure, because we did have an outbreak of Norwalk and other, you know, bird flu and everything else, just, you know, H1N1 just recently. So to have that many people in the camp with no sanitation, no water, no da-da-da-da-da, was very dangerous, we felt. So anyhow, the camp went up. We went in with our housing outreach workers and BC Housing. BC Housing is responsible for finding the housing. But, of course, our staff is well known to some of them, so they all went in together and did some assessments. But pretty much it was BC Housing's responsibility, and they did a great job. They were down there whenever they could to get in. And they found that, quite frankly, there weren't a lot of homeless people in that camp. They were mostly protesters, and they managed to find housing for about 30 people that were there. These are people who were probably in shelters, and our current shelters had moved to the camp, and then they used that to go into housing. The problem is, of course, is that when you start doing that, there are people on waiting lists already, and now you're jumping, you're queue jumping. Mm. So, of course, it creates an inequity in the system, and so BC Housing had to manage that, right? And then the activists, of course, then kept bringing in more and more people, whoever they could find to get housed. So, of course, now you're in the situation where it's a never-ending cycle. Mm. Well, the Olympics ended, and who was left in there but actually just a few homeless folks? And then we knew that some were homeless, and some were genuinely homeless, and some were not what we'd call genuinely homeless. And so that's why we were very quiet over the Olympic period in the media about it, is because we didn't want to upset the message that there is a need for a housing program. But again, there are problems with people taking advantage of a situation. So that woman who, you know, who went to the camp because she came from Quebec to check out the Olympics, and then she got thrown out of her friend's apartment because she'd spilled red wine on her friend's laptop, and so she had nowhere to go. So she went to the tent city and then demanded housing. Yeah. Go back to Quebec. I mean, you know. Are you genuine? You got a website and you're a performer? Like, give me a break, right? No, no. We got a guy who's got multiple mental illnesses, a guy who's got all these multiple problems, who genuinely can't stay somewhere.
Yeah.
We also know we had folks in there who were in the camp who had been thrown out of housing very recently or thrown out of shelters because they misbehaved. So they were either doing drugs or prostitution or they were beating up on people. So even if you gave them housing, would have it worked for them? They'd probably get thrown out of their housing because they were so untreated, right? So what we had to, you know, were these people, we sent the mental health workers down to find out if they can go to the hospital. And so another thing that we did on that mental health piece is that we worked with Coastal Health to support an urgent care center, which will be going in at St. Paul's Hospital. So this is places, it's like an emergency ward, but a little more long-term for folks with specific mental health issues, for example. As well as getting that money from the closed Riverview actually put back into the system where we now have beds, long-term psychiatric beds at Vancouver General Hospital, UBC Hospital, and St. Paul's. So we've got more capacity now for these folks. So, you know, that's how we solved it, essentially. You know, we had to go down and check every day and find out who was actually homeless. And, of course, that was difficult to do is because a lot of the protesters wouldn't let you in. You couldn't. I could not go in. For example, I didn't want to go in because if you're a political figure, they'll just jump you. You know, like, oh, Gary Jang, whatever. Or they might say great things. I don't know. But the idea is that, you know, you can't do anything per se. But the housing workers had to go in, and that's how they did it.
All right. In relation to like people who have who get kicked out of the house, and like kind of it's. What do you do when you when there's people who, for whatever reason, mental illness or whatever, just are kind of tend to, when you kind of try to put them in a housing community, just can't have real trouble kind of following the rules, and it's kind of you can't really keep them around because they're so disruptive. But
well, different nonprofits, I think, to understand different nonprofit groups take different clientele. So a group like the Portland Hotel Society specialize in the hardest to house. these are the folks they deal with, and they do a damn good job of it. And so that's why they're very prominent in the downtown east side, because that's where a lot of their clientele is. Other groups like Green City, they tend to do folks who aren't as difficult, you know, because their model, of course, is to build a community, so get them to self-police one another. So they run our shelters, as well as Dunsmuir House, for example. One shelter is run by the Aboriginal community because they specialize in that community, because their community. Mm. It's their brothers and sisters, right? And the shelter in Kitsilano is run by Coast Mental Health, because a lot of the clientele down there are folks recovering from mental illness. So each group specializes in their own, and the trick for government is to find out, to build enough housing for specific groups, right? And so that's what we work with. So of the 14 sites I mentioned earlier, one that we approved last night, the rezoning for, we run by the Kettle Friendship Society, where folks, this will be Directions Youth on Burrard Street. That's going up soon. We started Station Street with the province and a few others. These are for folks who are a little more harder to house, run by Atira, which generally does, women, hard-to-house women. Other ones will be run by St. James Community Services in due course. So these are folks who are less difficult to house. You know, the specialized mental health, the Kettle, and, you know, there's all different groups do different kinds. So the job for us is to find the right mix and balance, and that's what we work on every day.
Let me get my notes out here.
Sure.
We're kind of looking for, I guess, kind of memorable experiences from the kind of issue and community, from the community of housing. We were just wondering if there's anything particular that you, like a story you generally tell, or...
Well, I have a lot of million stories. It depends on... Oh, I don't know. I think one of the... I really don't know. Everything has been pretty amazing. I think from the day we decided to open shelters was a big decision for us. The day one of the shelters had difficulty on Granville Street and how it was difficult, but we learned a lot from that, so that was interesting. You know, it was very helpful and useful. Mm. The day we passed the mental health plan for Vancouver, the first day the staff wrote the mental health plan for Vancouver, was significant. Mm. I mean, there's like policy documents, but I think getting out there, I think the most memorable experience I had was over Christmas time. I went to First United Church, which was on our first shelters, and I went to the dinner, Christmas dinner. I just showed up just to pop in and say hi to the guys, and I really didn't know a lot of them then, but I got a big cheer, and it was pretty overwhelming. Mm. That was it. It was just something, wow. And then guy yells out, "Hey, Jang, next time wear a pair of jeans in here." That's not a yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah, and there was a couple of jeers because some guy, "Oh, this isn't good enough." But, you know, yeah. You're inside, you're fed, you're happy, you know, so far. Okay. And I think the other most memorable experience is the one I live every day, single day, waiting to see if something horrible happens and being able to manage problems before they arise. So you're always feeling uneasy, because although the shelters are running well right now, it's sunny outside, will this cause a problem, you know? Or, because that's what happened last time. As soon as the sun came out, the mistake we had was two shelters too close to each other, and we allowed lineups. This year we didn't. That was what we learned. But still, I mean, it may land up having some difficulty, but there's always that bit of anxiety that's always in the back of your mind, checking, double-checking without being a pest.
I know you already kind of touched on this, but we should ask for a professor, really. But we're interested.
It's good to please the prof.
What would you say is the kind of political landscape of the housing issue? Like, who's open to it, who's not?
Well, since we took office, I would say that everybody wanted to solve homelessness. I mean, I think that's been a constant. Mm. But how and what approach we should take has taken very different twists and turns. So we had the four pillars, which largely landed up focusing not on all four pillars. You know what they are, right? It's harm reduction, it's enforcement, it's healthcare, and it's prevention. Most of the effort went to harm reduction, so we had the safe injection site and all that kind of stuff, right? Needle exchanges. And then it went to law enforcement. Well, the best way of solving the homeless problem, or the, at that point, the aggressive panhandling, was to send the cops in on these blitzes, which, of course, cleaned it up for a little while, but then they always come back. And so that kind of happened. And then when we came in with a very different approach, and we said, well, we're going to build some housing with treatment. We've focused on the mental health. Now, this was kind of risky in the sense that everybody said, well, that's not your responsibility. In fact, Councillor Anton, the opposition, continually says this. Why are we doing the province's job? Why are we doing the province's job? And, you know, she's absolutely right from the legal perspective. But from a moral perspective, you have to do something. And so we decided to take leadership. And we said, we're going to work on mental health issues, which we have done. And I think by doing what housing we can, you know, with that mental health lens on it, has made a difference. In terms of the senior levels of government, the province in the last 2 years have really come on board. You know, people argue it's for the Olympics. Well, if the Olympics then spurred it on, great. Did what we hoped it would do, because they done fuck all. Up to that point, right? They done fucking diddly squat, and we saw them at the wards at UBC and VGH, right? And costing a lot of money, because you got to pay guys, to doctors, to treat them, right? Last couple of years, and maybe in prep for the Olympics, I don't know, they've actually done a lot. And, you know, Minister Coleman's come a long way, and he's been coming, you know, came forward with money for shelters and all that as well. But what we had to do is we had to forge a partnership. And the before everybody would say, you do it, you do it, you do it. So we said, well, the city can come up with $500,000 to do this. This is what we can bring. We will do all the leases, we will do all the negotiation, we'll do all the community consultation if you pay for this, that, and everything. So we came to these agreements. So that's how we're doing it now. Mm. So it's a real partnership between province and the city. It's taken a health and mental health approach as opposed to the law and order approach. I mean, even Mr. Coleman over the winter wanted to force people into shelters. He's an ex-cop. That's how we think. Make him go. I'm a big boy. Yeah. And I said, whoa, hang on there, big boy. I don't think that's the way to do it. Right? Because you can lead a horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. And he got it, to his credit. We had to work on it. But they modified the legislation. So you bring a person to the shelter, and if they go in, great. If they don't, you don't do anything. Our cops are even smart about it. We're just going to do what we always do. You want to go? No. Okay, fine. You know? I think that was the best approach. So we made the shelters, you know, we took a different approach to the shelters. Well, a lot of shelters had to be abstinence-based and all that kind of jazz. We simply said, look, you come in, you behave, you can stay. I don't care if you're high, drunk, or whatever. Once you're in, you don't use, you don't screw around, you don't beat anybody, and you behave, you can stay. As soon as you fuck up, out you go. Mm-hmm. Pure and simple. And people followed the rules.
So are the feds in the conversation at all?
No, they're a bunch of assholes. They just totally don't give a shit. To be honest, you talk, they talk a good game, they've done piss all. And it's very frustrating, because even in this last budget, absolutely nothing. Mm. Absolutely nothing. They don't give a damn, because they said it's a provincial responsibility. Mm. They don't have the guts, or they don't have the morals to do it. They won't take leadership on it. And that's probably why we have a succession of minority parliaments, because nobody's doing a very good job at the federal level.
The federal level.
Yeah.
It's a strong answer, but
seems accurate. Straight up.
And do you think...
And you hear that, Stephen Harper? All your fucking MPs out here? I hammer them every time I see them in China. You go out there to get the Chinese vote, you're going to hear about housing every single time.
So we've covered the kind of political landscape and a bit of your history. I just wanted to actually touch on that just one more time.
Sure.
If you could kind of, I guess... expand on the, in your kind of, what kind of personal interactions and kind of personal connections have you made by working in the, with the activist community around homelessness and with those kind of
groups? Well, that's a good question, actually. I don't really know. I think it's a lot. Okay, let's put it this way. So I've worked with some of them over the years, some more than others, but I had a fairly good reputation through my work at Collingwood Neighborhood House. He's a pretty reasonable guy. And then when we took office, I became a political figure. So then you become tainted in a sense, right? You know, you're not there. But I think both Andrea Reimer and I have worked very, you know, we set up meetings with all the groups. We'll meet with you. So we meet with the Carnegie, for example, monthly. We try to, and we answer their questions, and we listen to them, and you know, we don't always agree. But I think we've come to a respect for one another, whereas before it was always us versus them. Or saying, okay, well, you have some good ideas. Let's see what we can take of that. So on the housing issues, we were able to work more collaboratively. And so, for example, I may be able to say to one of the experts group, can you really talk about this issue to get federal attention for me, right? Mm-hmm. Keep calling on this. And then, or like when we had to close, the shelters are being, you know, getting ready to shut down for the season. They were very good in helping us in a non-attacking way, helping find people housing or helping us manage a situation. So that's been really good. And the same when they've had asked us to step in and help out. Like they asked us, don't send the, over the tent city, for example, are you going to send the cops in? And I told them, full stop, no, we're not. Mm-hmm. They trust me enough that, you know, we're good to the word. So we did send the cops in. So we've built up kind of like, okay, Jang says this ain't going to happen, then we can take his word for it. I think that's the case. Like, you have to ask them.
Yeah.
But that's what I get. Because when I, and I feel the same way about them, when I say to so-and-so, would you do this for me or can you help me out on this? They've been great. And I trust them. And we still differ on a number of issues, you know. But I think we have enough of respect for each other that we can work very collaboratively on issues and sing from the same songbook, you know. So if you want me to go hammer the feds, I'm happy to do that. And you will hammer the feds for me, or the province. You want to go make fun of Minister Coleman or somebody else, you go right ahead, you know. And I'm not going to castigate you for it, you know. I'll reiterate that message and so on and so forth. So like the red tents, we said, yeah, sure, well, let's work it out. How can you get... The question really was how do you get your message out? How can we help you get your message out? And so we worked it out, and it worked fine.
You've mentioned a few times on kind of how important collaboration is, both with provincial and with the groups in the work. And I just wanted, like, was that always the case?
No.
No?
No, I think there were a lot of groups who were anti-everything. Well, it really depends. I mean, the governments would say, oh, we don't like these activists because they're always embarrassing us in the media. But it's true, right? I mean, they screwed up. They deserve it. But, of course, it hurts their political careers, right? And then the activists say, we're always being ignored. And the province says, oh, hell with you. And the, whatever. It keeps going in these circles. Everybody was distrustful of everybody. You know, it's because they just didn't get along. And so you had groups like VANDU, Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, right? And so, you know, they're still on the fringes. But, you know, we said to them, look, what do we have in common? We came in clearly saying to them, okay, we're going to disagree, but what do we have in common we can work on? And they said, well, there's a lot of people getting run over in the downtown east side on Hastings Street there. Okay, how about if we fund a study, a proper study of crossing guards? How could we educate the people down there, A, not to cross the road, run the middle of the road, but at the same time educate drivers. So we're saying it's not just the homeless people's fault that are running across who get smacked because people want to teach them across the street, but how do we get people to slow down on Hastings Street so they can stop in time? So we worked on that with them. So despite the fact that we disagree with a lot of stuff that they think of, no, we stopped the ticketing. We said no more ticketing to poor people. Okay, good. We're all cool. That made a difference. Same thing. I work on the sex trade issues with different groups. So, I mean, that's, you want to talk about differences of opinion. You have the faith communities, which if you say the word sex trade, they get mad at you. You got to say prostitution because it is morally wrong. It should be eradicated. That's great. I believe it too. However, the reality situation, there are people who choose to be prostitutes and make a good living at it, and they quite enjoy their job. And it's their right to sell their bodies. That's what they maintain. And they call it sex trade and sex work. And so their issues are, how do you make it safe? And these guys is, how do you eradicate it? How do you bring these two groups together? They want the city to do something. They want me to sign charters saying that we should outlaw prostitution. It's really hard when you've got another group saying, you know, otherwise. You know, so it's like, wow. Yeah,
right.
So what we had to do was find something in common. So we all agreed that if there is somebody who wants to get out of the prostitution or the sex trade, how do we help them get out? So we agreed on that, right? We agreed on, so we started a project on that, right? A living communities project, which would provide resources for people who could escape their pimps safely. We also all agree that human trafficking is wrong. right? So during the Olympics, people were, you know, all that kind of stuff. So again, that was something we can agree on. We have to work on the other sides, but certainly there are common things that the city can do, because the city, for example, runs things like when we zone an area for a new building, do you allow in body houses? I mean, it's still in the Vancouver Charter. Massage parlors and other places like that. It's still on the book, so technically, you know, and who enforces it? Does it mean that the sex trade workers believe that, well, the cops shouldn't be the ones enforcing, the vice squad? So by changing city bylaws, who would be able to shut down a illegal thing? Not the cops, but the building inspectors. Mm-hmm. Different approach, so then they could, you know. So that's how we try to work it out. Same thing on housing. What do we agree with? Well, let's make people safe. Now let's get them fed, because they're dying on the street. We had a situation every year now. We've had homeless people dying on the street. We didn't see that before. We are seeing it every year now. And they're setting themselves on fire to stay warm. And even in the summertime, they're dying of heat exhaustion, as we saw it with Curtis Brick. This year, we had an assault. A flower seller was killed. And so our goal, how do we stop it? Get them inside, as many as we can, and save. It's not everyone, but if we save a life, it's been worth it. That's why we need these collaborations. We have to find what's in common. And the province said, yeah, we can't have people dying on our streets. And the province, we all agree with the province as well, that some neighborhoods may not want shelters, may not want this in their neighborhood. But, as you know, I love Minister Coleman. He said very bluntly, he said, well, tell them they got to suck it up and everybody's got to do their duty. We agree. Mm-hmm. So even though we closed the shelter last summer in Granville, we reopened it in Granville, you know, because we have a model that works, that is managed properly. We can demonstrate to neighborhoods, even where there's a lot of opposition, that it can work in all neighborhoods. And this year so far, it's been good. Last year, that one place wasn't so good. This year, I think we've demonstrated that properly managed, it can happen. Of course, that took collaboration. So at this time, we had the MLA involved, Mary McNeil, who did a lot for us, as well as our own staff.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to touch on... Do you want to touch on very quickly why it's so important to have a federal housing plan, and why it's like, why, because someone might ask, you know, why not just cities handle it, or why not just...
Well, cities only get 8% of every, 8 cents out of every tax dollar, mm. right? The province and the federal government get the most, but when we had a federal housing program, we did not have this many families at risk or this many homeless. Mm. Quite frankly, the infrastructure from the old federal housing is now running down. Rents in Vancouver are over, what, $1,000 a month? Mm. Easily, for a hole in a wall. And we need, who else can come to the table and help us build low, affordable housing? We're not talking supportive housing for people who are addicted, but just housing for regular folks to live in. And we had a very successful model with all the co-ops that were built across the city. Not only do we have to build new co-ops, we have to renovate and repair the ones that have fallen apart. And so if that falls apart, doesn't get built, you're going to have more people. It's more responsibility. There is a Canada Health Act, you know, it is their responsibility. They decided to walk away from it. Start with the Libs and carry on with the Conservatives. Thankfully, the NDP has consistently said, even when they're in power, not a part of BC, you know, no, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And they do it. And I'm a New Democrat, just so you know that I'm...
Generally, you see this shucking down responsibility from the federal to the provincial. How would you go about bringing responsibility back up to the...
Embarrass the hell out of them is one way. Mm. But secondly, show the leadership. Show the leadership, right? So the city says, look, we don't want people dying. We have a very strong voice. And we say, well, what can you do to help us? Here's what we'll bring to the table. We're not even asking you to do it. We'll actually do some of it, whatever we can, because we only get 8%, 8 cents of every dollar. And we got everything else to do, right? But we'll do what we can. And so we started the shelter program on purpose. Took that political risk. We didn't have to. Nothing said we had to. In fact, it's not in the charter. It's not in our responsibilities. But we had a responsibility as human beings to do it. And so we're saying to the other levels of government, do your responsibility. Province responded very positively and strongly recently. And the feds, well, they're in Ottawa, I guess. I've got a fairly little regard for the federal government on this issue. Absolutely none, actually. You know, they wouldn't even talk about it.
Do you have anything particular?
I'm still thinking.
All right. So I guess just as the last kind of thing, one more kind of, I guess, just I like to always end with like an open opportunity. Is there anything kind of particular you want to touch on or anything you want to share just as the kind of final parting words?
Final parting words? I'll just get involved.
Mm-hmm.
I think homelessness has been an issue in Vancouver now for a long time. I think there's a real willingness now over the last couple of years to be innovative and to try different things and to take some risks. And I must say that when we opened shelters, it was some opposition, but by and large, positive. You know, thank goodness you guys are doing something, and a lot of support. And I think when things are well managed, like they were so far this year, we had communities coming out and actually trying to help the guys in the shelters. You know, so on Broadway and Fraser, our shelter there, we've had people come in not only with food but to make offers of helping these guys out, and that way we can harness the community input. Because it just can't be done by government, is what I'm saying. Mm. Whole communities have to take responsibility for who's in the neighborhood. That's how I got started. I'm going to worry about Renfrew Collingwood, where I live.
Mm.
And what we're starting to see now, in a way, and I think it was always there, but it was just wasn't organized, was that in every neighborhood, they all want to, somebody wants to do something. But what we have to do is now channel that energy that exists into a project. And I think the shelters was one way of doing it. The homeless count yesterday was a clear demonstration of the willingness of Vancouverites to pitch in and do their bit. And I think as government, we have to harness that better. I think we're starting to do that. I don't think it was in the past. Certainly when I was out in the field working, it wasn't there. But I think that we're starting to see that change now. And that's what I hope continues.
Yeah.